All right, I found this file on the internet. I'm just going to link to it. Hey there, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Smush Rupert, and with me is Chris Redux for the Bucks Coyer. How are you doing, Chris?
Fantastic. What? It's a crazy week to be alive and part of the developer community, isn't it? Particularly if you at least passingly watch JavaScript Twitter. Just everything happened this week.
JS Twitter is buzzing. Wow.
It is. There's lots to talk about, and it's going to be really fun. We had the good fortune of having Mr. Michael Jackson reach out and say, like, hey, like, I don't know, but have me on the show. And anybody, please, if you really super want to be on the show, feel free to do that. We kind of have a list of people that we keep, but it's interesting to have ideas. But obviously, I've been a fan of Michael's work for a while. He does all kinds of cool stuff, particularly with React, but lots more than that. And we'll learn about that as the show goes on. But he's here with us. Hey, Michael, how you doing?
Hey, thanks for having me. Long time listener, first time caller.
Fantastic.
Hey, wonderful.
Regarding the drama, that's been going on JS Twitter, it seems like, whenever it dies down, like, there's just got to be something to bring it back.
Fill
you know?
The void.
I mean, yeah. Exactly. You get bored if there's no drama going on.
I don't know what I'd prefer, honestly. Sometimes I worry about if the drama gets so heated, and sometimes it really is emotional, which is when I find it gets a little unfortunate, because I would think that a beginner looking in on this world would be like, hey, what are the people talking about in this world? Ugh!
Oh, like, is it angry people.
Is it welcoming? I would think not, Anyway.
Do you think it's springtime? I'm going to blame springtime. I feel like if we went back through time, we'd find like a spike in activity around March 5th where JavaScript Twitter just takes off.
It's conference season. People are getting out, figuring out, okay, what am I going to speak about at this year? And they,
big idea.
Yeah, exactly. And everybody kind of got to have their spin on it.
Well, and I think you had the lull through the holidays, and then you hit the ground running on Jan. 1, and then, like, you think you have all the best ideas, and everyone's been doing it wrong because you approach it with a clear head. And now, 3 months in, you're ready to...
I took some time off over Christmas break, and I built a new JavaScript framework.
Mm-hmm.
I've got it figured out.
I've reinvented Moo Tools.
Oh, man.
Speaking of...
Yeah.
Yes.
Let's figure out who we're talking to a little bit first. Michael, can you tell us like who are you? You have a podcast. You run the React podcast. So this is a bit of a crossover episode in a way.
Yeah. So I've only been running the React podcast just for the last couple of months. Actually, we've only done 3 episodes, so maybe the last month or two at most. Before that, I ran a podcast called React 30. But anyway, I've been involved in the React community for a while now, for the last couple of years, at least since 2015. I've done a lot of React in my career. Wrote React Router, which is one of the largest libraries in the React ecosystem. Also,
so you're familiar with drama then, in a way. I remember that being quite the interesting twist when you did the React Router 4 thing.
I've developed a thick skin. Yeah, it's been kind of a crazy ride, and I'd be happy to talk about that as well. Just a couple other things that I've done is actually the first time I ever talked to you, Chris, I think was in relation to Unpackage. Yeah. Which is this CDN that I built for everything that's hosted on NPM, and that actually kind of came out of the React Router project as well. We just needed to be able to host our JavaScript files on a CDN.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. So we'll just shelve it for now and hear about your other stuff.
So yeah, I built a few things. Dabbled in Moo Tools back in the day.
Sure, who didn't really?
I actually got my start there.
That's fascinating. And so, and then these days, it's quite literally your career, right? Because not only the podcast and Unpackage and whatnot, but you are reacttraining.com.
That's right. Yeah. So I also run a training business. I train I've trained lots of different people over the last couple of years. I travel all around the world. Last year, I was in Australia, I was in Sweden, I was in the UK, and then obviously lots of different places here in the US. We're actually going to be running a couple of workshops coming up here really quickly. We're going to be in Austin, Texas next week. We're going to be in New York the week after that. We're going to be in Chicago next month, and Boston, wow, Santa Clara. Yeah, so we're going to be in quite a few places. So reacttraining.com if you're interested in learning up some React or getting
it's
your
selling a lot more tickets than mootoolstraining.com these days.
Well, I own that one too. I just gotta keep current, you know.
I own mootools-training.com, so we're gonna have to duke it out. So let's do these things in order, because I think that's just kind of fun, or order of release of drama, potentially. One of them was that there was JSConf Iceland, apparently. Wow, that would have been fun to go to. Apparently, I missed out there. Dan Abramov's talk caused quite a stir. It was called Beyond React 16. And I think it was maybe misreported really early on, because there's some people, I mean, perhaps they were just joking, and I don't know enough about JavaScript Twitter to catch on to it. But the thought was Dan's going to, as the creator of Redux, which is often hand in hand with React people. Yep. A lot of people that run React projects, they're really React plus Redux projects lot of times. And as the creator of it, where it was is he going to drop the Redux killer? Because that just would be something that he could do. And so I think it was reported that way a little bit. Like, Dan Abramov releases replacement to Redux, and that was maybe not actually what happened. Can you catch us up there? I'd actually like to know what happened exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, regarding Redux, I've talked to Dan quite a few times, just offline and in DMs and private conversations, where he's just like, Redux. You know, it's been great for him and for his career and for the community, but I think he's kind of you know, it's a framework, like you said.
I know the guy who invented pop-up ads on the internet famously really regrets doing that. Is it the same kind of thing?
Yeah, I wouldn't say he regrets it, but I think there are some core ideas about Redux that are really, really great. But I think people sort of put too much emphasis on it as sort of like, This is the solution. React has no way to manage state, therefore Redux.
Like global state or something.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because it certainly handles component level state pretty nicely.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's some follow up articles here. There was one that I enjoyed reading by Sean McKay, who released Redesigning Redux, and kind of talks about the where it came from and why and what could be better now and that kind of stuff. I can tell you that I have a active Redux project, and I don't think we regret it.
It works great. It works great. I think all I'm trying to say is there's still a ways to go. You know, it's got a lot of really great ideas. I love the reducer pattern. I love this idea of, you know, I've got this atom of state, new action comes in. What's the new state? Okay, now let's tell everybody about it. There was a library actually a long time ago for React called Cortex that was kind of a similar idea. It was kind of this, you know, this global atom of state. Of course, nobody uses it now, but it was kind of the very, very, very early days of React. I saw this project, and it was kind of a similar idea where, you know, if your React components are really just these like functions that generate some DOM or the view, and you can keep all of your state out of them, then, you know, you can just treat your whole UI as kind of like this single pure function, which is kind of an interesting idea. But anyway, I digress. With regards to the talk that Dan gave in ReactConf Iceland, you know, it was funny actually, because he was discussing really a lot of ideas for React that are, you know, they're not 100% fully baked yet. It's really just kind of alpha stage ideas. And you know, one was, you know, what if we had, you know, this ability in your render method So, you know, if you've ever built a React app, you know that, you know, the render method is like a pure function, right? Of props and state, and then outcomes, your UI from your render methods. Well, what if inside that render method, we could throw? And we're not throwing errors, but we're actually going to throw a promise for some data that we need to render something with. And so we,
so
they
like,
had this.
Hold on, like I'm not totally ready to render this chunky UI
exactly
because I don't have the data I need.
Exactly.
Yet.
Say you've got like a master detail view. You click on something in the master view. You need to load a bunch of data or whatever for the detail. Maybe you need to load an image or something, yeah. and maybe you're just you don't want to show the detail until it's ready. So yeah, you could throw a promise in that case and say, hold on, master view, I'm waiting on some data. Okay, now I'm ready.
So
now,
is there literally no way to do that now, or is it just a little tricky to work around?
Yeah, so the way to do that right now in React is, you know, you're going to have to write a little bit of kind of boilerplate code, you know, in your lifecycle methods. Maybe in the component will mount. Maybe you're using something like React Router. The component will mount, or the component will unmount, or in one of the router methods where it's about to change, you somehow indicate, hey, I want to pause the world on this master view for a little bit before we go over to this detail view.
I see. I would think like, yeah, I think I've used in the past, and I'm no master of this stuff. I'm just trying to catch, you know, hopefully this is helpful to people listening. I might have a component that does an Ajax call and to some API and gets some data, but I wouldn't wait to render it. I'd probably have like a component did mount or something, make the Ajax call in there that, and when it's done, it affects the state. And the, now that the state has arrived, it'll just render again once it has it. So it's not pausing the render. It still renders even though it doesn't have the data at first. And
absolutely.
So this is saying like, don't render at all until you get the data.
Well, yeah, I think that's a really, really common pattern. Right. And I think the focus of, you know, the React team at this point is, look, we see this pattern all over the place.
Yeah.
Is there some way that we could kind of generalize this and make
it feel
a little bit more kind of common, more like, you know, we've wrapped up and we've done some of that boilerplate for you. You know, like Dan said, if he said this on Twitter the other day, it actually feels synchronous when you're writing this code, you know? So you're down there in your render method, and then you open up your curly braces, and inside there you have a function call that is, you know, basically reading from your data fetcher that's saying, okay, go and get me this data. And if the data is there, great, you get the data. If not, it's going to throw a promise. React is going to pause rendering of that component. So anyway, it was actually really funny because
it doesn't sound like that has anything to do with Redux.
No, nothing. Well, no. No, you're right.
So I watched Dan's talk. It was online like within hours, I feel like, but it was I really enjoyed it. I thought these were actually really sensible patterns, kind of driven out of the idea of not throttling the CPU, because basically if you just try to render a whole bunch like synchronously or debounced, you get like bad performance, kind of like herky jerky stuff going on because you're overloading the CPU. But I felt like, you know, I was like, I think these are great changes for the React ecosystem, but I actually, you know, maybe me thinking it's a good thing is probably bad for React. So maybe that's a negative.
Well, the thing about the React community is like, they want to grow, right? They want to appeal to more types of developers. And I think the opinion of somebody who is sort of coming at it from the outside, I think is extremely important and relevant, right? I mean, if you're just coming to React from the first time and you're thinking, yeah, this makes a lot of sense, I think they've done a great job.
But, you know, and then on the same token, though, it's the whole thing about React. Oh, the state management. Use React. Mm-hmm. React, the state management. You got to put the Redux in the React because it'll have the state management, you know, that you crave. And for me, that is very true. I think that's like one of the reasons I would choose React is because it has beautiful like state management patterns. So I guess how did Dan's apparent, you know, atomic bomb, that's a React joke, but how did this, I guess, change in the API kind of affect Redux? Because or were people kind of conflating kind of the rumors that Redux is dead or needs to change?
I think it's his talk. I think it's conflated. So there have been a couple of things around Redux recently. So there's a new context API in React.
Okay, and we haven't talked about this at all. This is unrelated to the asyncy or promisey stuff. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of like that. So there's a new context API in 16.3, which fixes some of the problems with the old context API. So that it was kind of like this perfect storm of new context API, new potential way to do async. Oh my gosh, maybe all of this new stuff can replace Redux, and maybe we don't need Redux anymore.
What's a context API?
Yeah, I don't quite get it either, to be fair.
Yeah, for sure. So the context API, it's funny actually, because it used to be like this secret API, right? The React people didn't want anybody to know about context. And I was building React Router, like I said, a couple of years ago. And so the way the router works is you've got the router that sort of sits up at the top of your component hierarchy, and then you've got these links, which obviously change the page. And when you're building a single page app, you don't want to go to the server and refresh the page. You want the router to sort of intercept the clicks on these links and these requests for navigation, and then change the page for you. So we would intercept a request, I call them requests, but they're essentially clicks on these links. We would intercept that and say, okay, navigate. And the difficult thing about that was these links can be nested, at any point really in the hierarchy. So you could have all sorts of divs and spans and whatever you want around these links. And so we don't have a parent-child relationship with the router and the links. Never. We never really do, right? So how are these things going to communicate? You know, essentially, how are these things gonna coexist and work together? And that was when I started digging into the React code base. So I was like, this is just JavaScript, right? Like, yeah, the React is supposed to be pure, and these components just accept their props and whatever. But I'm gonna monkey patch this thing, and I'm gonna like figure out how to make my router work. And so I was digging through the code, and I found this thing called context, and I was like, what's going on here? Like, this isn't in the docs. This isn't anywhere, you know? So I cornered Sebastian Mark Boga, who's one of the core React developers. I cornered him at ReactConf 2015, and I said, hey man, I was digging in your code, you know? Essentially, I was like going through your sock drawer, and I found this thing called context. What is that? And he's like, well, it's kind of this way that you can implicitly pass props from a parent to a child. So in other words, this thing that I was thinking about where the router needed to talk to the links, which are way down in your component hierarchy, they had a way that was built into React to do that, but there were some sort of caveats around it. One of the performance optimizations that React has is it has this method called shouldComponentUpdate. And that's really powerful in an API when you're thinking about, you know, again, your UI is just a function of state. You can say, hey, if the state doesn't change or if my props don't change, I don't need to update. Me and all of my descendants in the component tree, we don't need updates because the only thing we're listening to is these props coming in. And if the props don't change, it's like if I call a function with the exact same arguments and it's a pure function, I should get the exact same result, right? So why re-render? Why re-render all that stuff?
And that kind of magic is why people like React at all, right? Because it's
exactly.
That's what makes it performant.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's a performance optimization. But then when you're talking about implicitly passing props using this context thing, well, you can see how those kind of conflict, right? Because one of them is very explicit. The should component update says, nope, I shouldn't update, but it doesn't know about the props that are being implicitly passed via context. So anyway, so we add this kind of, you know, this context API that was around and people were using it, and we were using it in the router and they were using it in Redux, but it had this weird caveat. So in 16.3, Andrew Clark, one of the core React developers, he said, let's fix this. Let's figure this out. So we were actually using a pattern in React Router, this kind of like pub-sub kind of pattern. And that's actually a very similar pattern that they ended up adopting for the new React Context API. But that's all that context is it's basically just a way to pass data from a component that's very high up in your hierarchy to a component that's low down.
Isn't that a thing that Redux does? I mean, I feel like I use that pattern a lot. The like map state to props.
Yes.
That's a container component. And that's the whole deal, right?
Well,
so that does replace a little bit of React.
Yes, exactly. So you're already going down that route and saying like, well, if I've got that in that new context API, why would I need Redux anymore, right? So yeah, if that is the only thing that you're using Redux for, is to basically get data down deep in your hierarchy, then context would probably replace Redux for you, right? But there's this other thing that Redux does, right? It's you know, you've got the reducers, you've got these ideas of, you know, actions and the dispatch. You might be using some Redux middleware. You might be using like a Thunk middleware or the sagas or what have you, right, for doing asynchronous work. And so, you know, context does help you with the distribution of data in a component hierarchy, but it doesn't implicitly have all of that other stuff, right? You don't have reducers, you don't have actions, you don't have middleware. So there are, you know, Redux is actually going to use this new context API eventually, as will React Router, and probably many other React libraries will use this new context API. But Redux is more than just the distribution of data. It also has to do with, you know, governing how changes come in and affect the state. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's more than just a distribution channel.
Just a part of it. That's a good explanation of all that. So you know, it would be very difficult to write a headline that that surmises all that. So no wonder that people struggled to explain it.
For sure. Well, and so that was one piece of it, right? And then there was this like async API, which hilariously some people were like already putting into production. I saw Dan tweet the other day. He's like, hey, please don't use alpha versions of React on your production website. Stuff's going to break, you know?
And that's this suspense API.
The suspense API is basically what we were talking about before, is where you're, you know, you're down in your render method, you realize, oh, I don't have everything that I need yet to actually render. So maybe I can, call this method, which behind the scenes throws a promise, which React can effectively catch and then say, oh, okay, because you've thrown, I see that you are not yet ready to render. I'm going to wait until this promise resolves and then I'll render you. So it's just kind of it's an experimental way that's actually built into React that should, in theory, help you avoid some of this boilerplate that we were talking about earlier with the lifecycle methods and things like that.
Fantastic. Thanks for all that.
There's
so much more rapid fire news to do. Let's do another one. Let's do a quick one and then we'll do a deeper one. We saw this was just kind of a holy war argument that I think is kind of fun, and that was it's what I've seen pop up every year or so, which is the how much does view source matter anymore? I don't know if it was a Tom Dale subtweet or if he started it or what, but it was kind of this idea that there's certainly a lot of people that are out there that like view source is how I learn. View source is vital to having, you know, kind of people just getting started in the industry or people understand what's happening here is that there's some things that threaten that. Certainly, I guess I might argue that it's that ship has sailed already in a way. Yeah. That
oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, I remember, you probably did the same thing, Chris. I remember. Yeah. So I did some web development. It was probably around 1999 or 2000. I was doing web development and we were still using tables back then. And then I took a break and I came back in 2003 and like the pages were full of these div tags. And I was like, div, what's that? You know, and that's how I learned. And that's probably how you learned a lot, right? You just crack open the, the source of a web page. You view it. You check out.
Do you think even back then, though, if there was a tool to help you crack it open that made it way more understandable, you probably would have cracked it open with that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, you know, binary formats are obviously, not obviously, in my opinion, I think they're the future of the web. You know, we're talking about, you know, we've got, you know, compiling our JavaScript down to bytecode. You know, a lot of the, you know, we've got WASM, which is basically WebAssembly, is on the horizon. We've got
even at a higher level, like minification is like mm-hmm. Are the same people arguing for Vue Source saying don't minify your code because then people can't look at it? Where are you landing on this, Dave? I feel like you're deep in thought.
Well, so this week, I'm gonna just bust your whole argument here with one example. So fluent.microsoft.com. It's Microsoft's brand new Fluent design system. I'm very interested. It's kind of like, oh, you know, any digital product from like phones to VR or AR or whatever. Very, very handsome page. You scroll. It kind of has the sliding page effect, a little parallax, et cetera, et cetera. Like, and I just was like, oh, how are they doing this? Well, crack open Web Inspector. And I'm like, I scroll. The only thing I see changing in the Web Inspector, like by default, is like the opacity changing on some div at the bottom of the page. And I'm like, well, that's probably not it. Like, because you don't get parallax just by changing opacity, like on scroll. So I just was like, okay, well, now where do I kind of go? And I had to click into every single div on every single tier of the web page to kind of like piece together what was kind of going on, because all the divs names are computer generated. So main class MSD Fluent. Okay, that looks like a human wrote that. Next one, section class SC-BD capital VA capital JA space modifier class B capital W E.
That's just your atomic CSS, Dave. That's atomic CSS right there.
But it's something has packed this and made it unreadable. I mean, so this has gone through.
And you're saying that even Web Inspector isn't helping you here. Even these advanced developer tools.
It's a garbage town. And so, like,
can't learn from it, and it's not open source either. Is that the idea? There's no repo or anything.
No, I can't do nothing with it. And so you go to, okay, well, let's just go see what the raw stuff is before the JavaScript took over. Nope, div ID root. Okay, yeah. Well, that was fun. I'm, you know, like, I guess if I don't know, if I just all of a sudden want to, like, unminify all of this, like, you know, 10 megs of JavaScript, maybe I'll finally understand how they made, like, a div slide over another div. That would be really, really cool. But now it takes 10 hours to figure out how a website achieved like a simple.
Well, CSS. And if you can't do it, then nobody can, kind of, right? I mean, sure,
I'm pretty good at websites.
Right.
Well, so,
yeah.
Okay. So that's a great counterexample that could be thrown at this. But what the counter argument would be that if they didn't do some of that stuff and made it easier to learn from, that there be a performance penalty to it. Would you say that performance penalty is okay for the?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I like source maps obviously go a long way. Yep. I do think like this idea that the Web Inspector is maybe the replacement for Vue Source is like a very true thing. I like Vue Source, you just view the source. It doesn't really tell you much. I mean, I can almost make up the source in my head by like looking at the network graph, you know? But at the point where it's impossible to like dig in and figure out how something is pieced together, that's like, that seems like an issue, you know? I mean, you get into binary code formats and stuff like that. That's really cool. But like, what data are they collecting on me? What does this website do? I don't know. Like, there's no transparency. And I feel like transparency is how the web wins. And
I think it might just be, Dave, that we've developed the tools to deploy faster than we've developed the tools to understand what is being deployed, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, because
that's actually a very common trend. That's the same. I've been watching a lot of machine learning. That's like a lot of machine learning. Like we can, like, we can train machines to recognize dogs, but the machine can't tell us how it knows that it recognizes dogs. So there's kind of like, there's this gap between, like, we can train machines, we can make machines do amazing things and pack and deploy and everything, but we can't, the machine can't tell
us why it is. Where we're headed here is that there's a catching up that will likely happen in both regards?
I think so. I mean, what if the Webpack team, you know, which is kind of the state of the art, I guess, for deploying web stuff these days. You know, what if they decided, okay, now that we've made this big ball of wax for you to deploy, now we're going to make a tool so you can sort of understand the ball of wax, you know, and maybe it's a Chrome extension or a Firefox extension. Maybe it's just a thing that you can plug into your browser and say, because I mean, I can read a Webpack bundle and kind of like figure it out just because I've deployed enough of them that I've, you know, sort of learned, okay, this is what you look for. But, you know, it's still not as good as just give me the name of the original file and what was the code that the person, that a human wrote before you compiled it from your, you know, with your Babel and you deployed and bundled it with your Webpack. And then, so, you know, what if the teams working on the tools could, I actually think, you know, the Webpack I think that would be a prime product for them as a team. Like they could probably sell that.
And there are some, there's like the, like Source Map Explorer or I think there's a Webpack like Explorer thing. I mean, those are handy, but that's kind of also like just size related, you know, just like,
I think part of your argument too, Dave, is a moral argument, right? It's like the web wins because it's open. And it used to be a lot more transparent than it is now. And so I think that's important. That's the feeling, right, that we have being people who have developed on the web is that, you know, it used to be this way. It used to be understandable. Why isn't it understandable anymore? It should be.
Well, here's another thing that changed is that there's 20 billion zillion learning resources now that there didn't used to be two. So it seems like that's got to factor into this in some way. Like maybe the production websites get a little less readable, but there's the community's 50 times bigger than it ever was, and writing and training.
And Stack Overflow.
Well, there's also like a business angle. Like somebody pulls up fluent.microsoft.com and they love it, and they're like, "Dave Rupert, build this for me." And it's like, I don't know. I mean, I could try, but and then I can't. There's like the effort and tools required to like evaluate: did they do a good thing? Did they do a good job, or is it just good on my like $3,000 computer? Is different than like, you know, like, I don't know. It's like, can I even recommend this? Okay, it's going to take a long time to figure that out. And then could I build another one? You know, there's so many, I don't know, just almost like competition, like now sort of starts siloing into like huge dev machines, you know, that's my opinion, but.
So, different thing. Nicholas Gallagher, longtime CSS guy. We know, you know, just he's written interesting, fascinating stuff for years. Maybe even Normalize is one of his greater impact achievements. Fascinating dude. Goes to Twitter, starts working on their mobile products, gets into React, particularly into React Native, I think, and produces some of the Twitter stuff through React Native. I think he's got his own repo where he's kind of decided that React Native is really cool, and there's no reason that the web can't be a target for it. So it's billed as a product, React Native, write your code in React, and we'll make a native mobile app for you, like an Android app or an iOS app or whatever. But also, there's no reason that apparently that it can't target the web as well, which is news to me. And I see a tweet the other day that's like, not only can we do this, it's quite a good idea, and it just solves a slew of problems. Anyway, he's a big fan, and it was like, I was like, I didn't even know that was a thing, dude. So, you know, we could probably get Nicholas on to talk about it, but you've talked with him about this recently, right, Michael?
Yeah, we had him on the React podcast. He was my very first guest because I was, like, super excited about what he's doing with React Native Web. So
how did I do it? Did I characterize it okay, or do you want to reframe that?
You're pretty much right on, except there's the idea is not, write once, run anywhere. Which I'm not saying that you were saying that, but it could seem.
I have said that though. When I reacted to this in my blog, I was like, is that? I don't know, but I postulated, would that be cool? Like, how cool would that be? Right?
Yeah. It would be cool, but I think a lot of people, are pretty wary of that nowadays, and I don't think that's what Nicholas is trying to do, just because it seems like there's always some catch whenever you try and do that. I think what he's doing instead is he's saying, look, the web, I mean, when you look at the web API, how it's evolved over the years, the DOM API, I mean, we've got this whole slew of elements in HTML5, which are really just like, they're just block level elements, right? And I feel like HTML5 tried to get, we introduced a footer element and a header element and a nav element and a section element, and it's like,
sure, I've heard this argument, and they don't do anything. They may have some semantic benefit, and there's probably some light accessibility roles attached to them for free, but the true benefit is maybe perhaps a little light.
Well, just the idea that the DOM API is huge. It's huge, and it sort of just keeps growing, right? And I think what Nicholas is saying is, he's saying, look, we've got this very, very simple API on React Native, right? We've got a view element and a text element. And everything else is some sort of combination of those two things. And we can also, build in features to this view element at a higher level. So for example, instead of having a div, for example, which basically gives you no features besides the fact that it's a block level element. Other than that, it's just, you don't get anything, right? What if you could have, some accessibility information associated with that element, or some sort of styling information associated with that element, without having to go and resort to like using a style tag or using an ARIA attribute or something. So we have these kind of higher level concepts already built in to these elements that we're building. So we can build in things like, what would be a good example? I don't know. Like imagine if the web gave you a list view, right? Which it doesn't, obviously, but so everybody's been building them from scratch.
Isn't that like a bad example? Isn't that one of the one things that React Native doesn't have?
Oh, no, they've got it. They've got a list
view. They've got list?
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, they got a list view. They got like a flat list, and they've got a something or other.
Okay, cool.
But couldn't we provide a better set of primitives, I guess? I guess Nicholas's whole point is just that the DOM is not a good set of primitives. Couldn't we provide a richer set of primitives that, where people don't have to manually tack on the accessibility? Because accessibility, as you know, is so often just completely ignored or overlooked in web apps. And, could we help people do that more easily by giving them higher level elements that are already accessible, for example? Or could we help people build these more complex things by giving them basically higher level abstractions that are already, capable of doing things like rendering long lists. And so I think that the whole idea behind React Native Web is, let's throw out the DOM. The DOM's bad. And let's just do everything with these views and these text elements, and sort of rethink the whole API that we use for building things and provide a better set of primitives.
And it'll deal with the DOM, because you can't not.
No, right? Of course. Eventually, everything's going to boil down and be DOM at the end of the day. But you, as the developer, you get to use a higher, higher level set of primitives that is going to.
Right, it's in some way, it's like a weird step up the ladder. But React is that anyway, right? In a way.
Yeah, for sure. React is that anyway. I think it's just. you know, Nicholas has an interesting perspective because of, you know, the product that he was working on. You said he was working on, you know, mobile Twitter, essentially. They've got a huge user base that they need to serve. They've got, you know, they need to support all sorts of things. They need to support right to left languages. They need to support, you know, multiple different, you know, ways of formatting things like dates and currencies and whatever. They also need to be very, very fast. Anyway, I think he's just gotten some constraints from building that and some experience from building that product that, you know, where he looked at the DOM and was just like, really? I have to build something really, really good with this really just not impressive set of tools.
It's kind of funny. One time I was, this is years ago, gave a talk about SaaS, I think, and I was kind of trying to make a point about abstraction in general, because in a way you could think if you really bought into writing in a CSS preprocessor, you've kind of just said, I'm going to step up the ladder of abstraction one more level. And CSS does what it does, but I want to write in this abstracted way. And then if you're like, okay, well, like, let's look at the beginning of computers at all and how we write code for computers. It kind of seemed like loosely you could map every about 10 years as somebody decides to take a step up the ladder of abstraction from ones and zeros to other the languages that go on top of the assembly to then compilers and stuff.
And we try.
It's kind of funny.
And every once in a while, you have to step back down a couple of steps, right?
Sure.
Somebody just handed me a SaaS project the other day, and I was like, "I'm gonna have to back out of this one. I'm not a huge fan of like the, you know, the abstractions over CSS that exist."
Right. But yeah. So this would be just like it seems to me like an attempt at stepping up, and another step up the abstraction level a little bit.
I would definitely describe it like that. Yeah, and I think, you know, to be fair, I think he's had some good experience, you know, like I said, some highly relevant experience that not a lot of people get to have, and so I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt on this one. He's one of the smartest people I've ever talked to, so I've been very impressed with React Native Web in general, and I think he needs a better name though, React Native Web, because I think when people hear that name,
what do you get? Like it's very strange because it's kind of like we talk a lot about frameworks and stuff, and you know Dave just mentioned this Fluent one. I haven't even seen it, Dave. I hope you should shoot me a link or something. But I've been reached out to about once. I wonder if I even got an email about this one. But there people are like, you know, we want to do this framework. What do you think about it? And my response is always like, you know how popular Bootstrap is, right? Like, I know your thing is different in some way, or you're tackling it from a different way, but look how popular it is and look at why it's so popular. It has great docs. It's so easy to build stuff. That's the bar. And then people release something and then it's worse in some way, or it doesn't take off in the same way you did. It's because you didn't hit that bar. There's the bar. Yeah. Beat it. You know,
it's like whenever somebody tries to build an email client, it's like, No.
Look at the bar.
Is it going to be better than Gmail? The answer is no. So why are you doing this? Sorry, Dave. Are you building an email client? You're smiling.
No, but I do. I don't like the Gmail client. I don't know. But anyway, I think my only issue. So I think like it's actually kind of cool. Like that. Like if you wrote React Native and you're targeting native, like. It's awesome. And then you just kind of import this basically and you get like a free web.
But it's unstyled or is it styled? What do you get from React Native Web? Does it look like something when you use it?
They use something that looks a lot like CSS. They call them style sheets on React Native. And React Native Web uses that exact same API. So you say stylesheet.create, you pass a JavaScript object with all the, you know, camel cased property names that looks kind of like CSS. And so you know you can reuse some of the code. I think he said recently there was like a Flipkart mobile site where they had something crazy like 98% code reuse.
I would think if you want people to use it, ship some themes with it. I know that sounds dorky and like maybe against
I totally agree.
Yeah, ship a couple nice looking themes and people will pick it up just because they want the styling for free, and then they'll learn that it's possible.
Yeah, and a bunch of like sort of default controls come right out of the box. You know, here's a little slider, and here's a you know, here's a checkbox that doesn't look terrible.
I definitely have had that emotion over time. Like, how many developers right now are hand coding a drop-down menu, you know? Oh. And maybe that's good and maybe that's bad, but it seems like a lot of maybe potentially wasted brain resources of smart people, and maybe someday that those things will be nativized or abstracted away in some way. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Roll Bar, longtime wonderful sponsor of Shop Talk Show. Rollbar.com/Shop Talk Show, which is how you get the free bootstrap plan on them. Very generous and very cool. It's about tracking errors in your web application. If you find that some action or URL or something on your app is triggering like a page ruining 500 error or something, you shouldn't be waiting for an email about that to find out. That's on you. You need to be figuring that out. You shouldn't be looking through logs and crap. You instantly know what's broken and why with Rollbar. So there's some extra cool features in Rollbar that you should know about. One of them is source maps. So if you ship source maps with your code to your apps, which is usually just like part of a build process, not that hard of a thing to do, Rollbar supports using those source maps to get meaningful stack traces while still using like minified code for your actual like production JavaScript, which is great. And the telemetry feature. So JavaScript telemetry gives a timeline of browser events leading up to an error. It's like a black box recorder, like in airplanes, but for when your web app crashes. So you just have lots of contacts. You know exactly what went wrong when something goes wrong. That's incredibly vital for any web app. You can integrate it into your workflow really easily. You can have errors sent to Slack or HipChat or Jira or whatever. Integrating into your app is just a few lines of code. It's just a miracle product. Check it out, rollbar.com/shoptalk. All right, last thoughts. We got a couple more drama items to hit here.
Yeah, I guess my only thing is, like, React Native obviously chases the native platforms, mm-hmm. tries to, like, follow them. And this mean, if you use opt-in to React Native for web, it's kind of like you're saying, well, I can only use what's on the native platforms. You don't, like, get to bake your own weird things.
That's, that's on purpose, right? They're like, no, we're giving you a limited subset on purpose.
Yeah, probably. And so I think that's, I don't know, not a big fan of subsets, AMP, etc. I just would rather have the whole bucket of Legos. Yeah. But there's also value in, like, I think value, especially on like a big team and stuff like that, where you kind of don't want people just making their own little doodads. Haven't
you also used though like an API that's very small, and you're like, wow, that API gives me everything that I need. You know, like sometimes. And it's hard to do that. It's hard to build a small API. It's so easy to be like, whatever. Somebody needs to do something else with my code. We'll just tack on an extra method here. We'll tack on an extra property there. I mean, just look at, I don't have to name anybody. There are a bazillion huge APIs out there. And the DOM, I think, is one of them. So, you know, whenever I guess it's just my spidey senses start going off. Whenever I see a super large API, I'm always like, what are they really trying to do with this? You know?
Yeah, it's like, that's too many things.
Yeah, it's too much stuff here.
We've seen APIs fail, and I know there's different types of them and ways to think about it, but certainly jQuery succeeded based on its API being really cool and really likable in a way, and things like IndexedDB fail because people are like, what?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's failed, but it's certainly not popular. Cool, here's one. Mootools. Dave tweeted, I haven't seen that come up in a hot minute on the web. You know, remember back in the day, it was kind of jQuery versus Mootools, and some people really preferred the Mootools way of working. Certainly got lost in jQuery's shadow, but I remember in my experience back in the day, it was so funny watching David Walsh, who's, you know, still a friend and co-blogger in the world, was so on the Mootools wagon. It was hilarious. But
well, why are we... So I understand that some people built some stuff in Mootools, right? I totally get it. It was great. Yeah. It was a fun time. I built some stuff in Mootools.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's like influencing...
Wait, why are we talking about Mootools right now? Do you want to set it up?
I interrupted you. I just sort of assumed that everybody knows why we're talking about Mootools. So,
they probably don't, I think.
Once upon a time... TC39 wanted to create a new method for arrays called flatten or flat map, right? I think
flatten map. Yeah, flatten and flatten map. Yeah.
Two new APIs, brand new. They got new names.
Yeah. So it's like a big old gnarly nested array thingy-ma-bob, and it just flattens it down into a flat thing. But MooTools, in its former glory, extended the arrayed-up prototype with a flattened method. And they have basically, they are now camping on this domain, this namespace. They're domain camping. The JavaScript, I guess TC39, said, well, we can't do, there's like a web compat issue if we try to do flatten, like array.flatten or whatever.
What if they, do they work slightly differently? Like if they would do the exact same thing, why does it matter?
I think the API would be different. I think the API would be different. Like what do you pass in or whatever? And so there would be a compat issue, and so it was proposed we should call it Smush.
So that the JavaScript actual language, the API itself, can't do the thing that it wants to do because of an ancient library camped on this space. Yeah. And so there's the reason this makes such a great tech story kind of thing, and as I'm sure this has happened a million times, and I bet if you asked Mike Taylor, he'd have 500 examples of crap like this that's plagued.
Well, isn't like a...
includes contains, and contains, yes.
Includes... Like, that's all weird and messed up because somebody...
We already had this conversation. They wanted to call it... What would you name a method that tests if an array has something in it? Well, contains, has. Right? Has. Array dot has. Yeah. There you go. Array dot... I always default to array dot contains, and then I'm like, oh, no. It was...
Why? What is thing. It? It's not contains? What
it's,
is it for real?
It's includes...
Includes
array dot includes, right?
So, and this was this because of MooTools too, or did somebody else offend yep. this one? It nope, was because of MooTools,
yep.
Okay, so back in the day, why did MooTools decide this was a good idea? Was it cool because you're like, oh, you don't have to, it's just MooTools is like the web on steroids, you don't have to like use special MooTools wrappers. You just once you have this library installed, any native array you could now do fancier things on. Well, so that was the promise, right?
You know, why MooTools did it is because Prototype did it. Sam Stevenson. Oh. He's the real catalyst here. Sam, yeah. So you need to get Sam on the show and ask him. Be like, Sam, it all comes back to you. You named your JavaScript library.
Are you like the pop-ups guy? Do you regret it?
Extending prototype or what?
Well, so he named his library prototype because that's what they did. He was like, wow, I discovered this meta programming interface to JavaScript. It's called the prototype. And I can just put stuff on the prototype and then any object I create of that type has these methods. So, the real goal.
To be fair to him, JavaScript was doing nothing back then.
Oh,
like, it was almost dead.
I'm not critiquing what he did. Yeah. I think it was awesome. The real gold mine was HTML element.prototype. Because then even your DOM elements could have like weird methods on them, which was pretty cool. So MooTools was just kind of looking over at prototype and going like, oh, that's a good idea. We should do that too. So MooTools did it as well. The only reason we're talking about MooTools instead of prototype in the TC39 discussions is because you actually have people who were, I mean, it comes down to people. There are people on TC39 right now who used MooTools back in the day. There are not so many people, to my knowledge, on TC39 who are big aficionados of prototype. So we're talking about MooTools. But like I kind of feel like Chris does in that, in this particular case, if Flatten does essentially the same thing, yeah, it's got a slightly different API, but it does essentially the same thing. So what's... Why?
What are they going to do? What do you think? If you had to bet me a dollar?
Well, I mean, if we just look based on history, right? Where they with the whole contains includes thing, I think they're just going to try and find a different name.
And they're going to rename it. I bet they will too, because I think that I think erroring on not breaking stuff is absurd as it feels sometimes is probably a strength of the web. Here, this is interesting because you brought up Sam Stevenson. I think it just rung a bell to me because I think he's had to address this personally and think about it internally for a while. So I found his blog post about it. So let me just read aloud if I would, because I think this is interesting. So, you know, he introduces what prototype is and he says the idea quickly took hold. Ruby on Rails adopted it. You know, Apple starts using it. New York Times sometimes use it. After some time, though, it became clear that Prototype's core idea was at odds with the world. Browser vendors responded to the JavaScript renaissance by adding new APIs, many of which conflicted with Prototype's implementation. As developers began to show a preference for small, self-contained modular libraries over monolithic frameworks, in just a few years, Prototype went from best practice to anti-pattern. And depending on who you listen to, this might... You might be convinced that it was one of the worst things to happen to the web. The reality is that Prototype helped lots of people despite its flawed foundation. But its time has come and gone. I eventually realized it was time to move on. It was hard not to take Prototype's failure personally. Critical blog posts felt like a full assault on my values. And seeing friends use other libraries made me feel like my work was a waste. And he goes on, but we'll link this up because it was. This is obviously a quite a personal thing to happen. And oh my gosh, can you imagine?
Yeah. Well, you know, think about the things that originated in Prototype. People listening may not realize this. When's the last time you used function bind? That was a Prototype thing. You know, you know, you used to just have call and apply, but bind, that was a really, really useful thing. I remember, you know, like they called them the ES5 array methods back in the day, but this is all like very, very standard fare nowadays to have, what were some of them? Filter, reduce. Reduce write, obviously. Right. So, you know, these are some of those
came from it. And, you know, think of jQuery's legacy. What is there, 20 or something jQuery things that made it native?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
It's you know, we have a lot to be thankful for, I think, to these people who just, you know, they started building stuff in JavaScript. And I don't think they, you know, could see 20 years into the future and realize that, oh, there's going to be a discussion in some meeting where they're going to be upset, you know, with this decision that I've made. But
it's a little bit like, it's like pushing your hand into this wet cement when they do your sidewalk and then somebody trips on it 15 years later.
You know, you go walking your dog, little dog paws in the wet cement. But yeah, I think that, you know, I think they'll probably end up, just to answer your question, I think they'll probably end up just choosing a different name. But yeah, we definitely have a lot.
It's not going to be Smoosh. That would be crazy if it was Smoosh.
I saw a tweet from Evan Yu this morning. He's the creator of Vue, which is another, you know, JavaScript framework. He's like, you know, I didn't even know Smoosh was a word.
You're not a native speaker. It's very weird.
Exactly.
I don't know if he is or isn't.
You know, maybe it was intentional. I don't know if it was for real. But I could see a couple people like thinking, oh hell yeah, we cracked it. but I think there's maybe it was like chosen to, like, you know, sometimes you just choose an API just to get responses, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe it was part of
that. Oh yeah. Isn't that a David Rupertism? I heard somebody quote it the other day. It was, there's no better way to get the right answer. You know, you don't ask for the right answer, post the wrong answer.
That's not Dave Rupert. That's actually a eponymous law belonging to somebody else. I'll look it up. I have a blog post.
Yeah, I like that too. Yeah. Or if you think there's 8 ways to do something, publish a blog post that says the 5 ways to do something, and you'll get those last 3. You know.
We've been talking about that at Paravel. It's almost like the, human nature, you know, like sequencing, you know, if you see A, B, you know, and C, D, and then you put that up, people are going to go, E, you know, that's the answer, E, you know, like they like make a connection. They want to fill out a sequence. Like you can almost game that, you know, but that's kind of the thing too, is like, you just like, if you just post the wrong answer or an answer, people will suddenly like, chime in.
So you think TC39 is gaming us all right now? It's basically what you're
saying.
I think
they're gaming the system. Yeah. I think they've figured out how to do it.
That's possible. So that's quite possible.
It's smart people over there. Mm-hmm. So
they've been studying up game theory.
Yeah. Let me see. I'm going to find the name of the actual law here. Cunningham's Law. The best way to get the right answer on the internet is not to ask a question, it's to post the wrong answer.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try that. I'm going to, oh my gosh, I'm going to totally do that. Yeah.
Yeah, just say the wrong thing. It hurts like hell because, boy, do you have to hear about it.
I feel like, you could.
It's great.
So I'm actually working on this new little, I'm working on this new product with a friend of mine, Drew Wilson. So I live in Carlsbad, California, and he does.
Oh, that Drew Wilson, like Plasso? And
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's a great friend of mine, and we are, we're building a cryptocurrency wallet app for the phone called Versa. And one thing that I decided to do is, as I'm building this app, I am going to build it out in the open. So every day I'm going to post a log to YouTube of what I accomplished the previous day. So kind of an interesting thing happened yesterday that relates to all of this. I posted a video and I was walking people around my code and I was like, here's how I did this and I did this. And then somebody posted a comment and they're like, why didn't you just do this? And I was like, oh, that was incredibly helpful for me, right? So when you're developing stuff, I don't know how many people, you know, listening to the podcast develop stuff on their own, but it can be kind of a tricky thing, right, to develop in isolation. And sometimes you don't have the best ideas. Sometimes you're wrong, right? But sharing it and putting it up somewhere publicly for everybody to see gives somebody else the opportunity to say, hey, I think you got the wrong answer there. I think this is better. It's actually really cool. I kind of wish, after having this experience over the last week, developing this app in the open, I kind of wish that I could do all software like this and just put my code out there in the open and then have other people come along and say, hey, here's where you're wrong. It could be better like this. It's kind of an interesting thing that's happened to me over this last week. I don't know. I guess open source is supposed to do that, but open source doesn't do that. GitHub is just a place for people to come and like gripe basically and get free work.
Speaking of that,
why isn't this working on my website?
I just happened to see some kind of some GitHub slight drama with PhantomJS. Looks like PhantomJS is kind of thrown in the towel and not going to develop anymore, but I don't know how big of a, I mean, it seems like a huge project. I'm sure tons of people use it in production, but the rise of the headless browser is certainly going to.
I think JS DOM is the new thing, right? I think JS DOM is finally. When I first heard of JS DOM, I was like, this is crazy. Oh, so JS DOM is like it's a pure implementation. It's a pure JavaScript implementation of the DOM. So you could run it on Node and basically pretend like you have a window and a document and a HTML element.
I would say that 50% of the usage of things like this are to export a image of. can it do that?
Or to run your like one little test suite where you're like.
Yeah, you know, testing is probably the big thing, but image creation is another one. Can this do image creation? I'll have to look at it. That'd be
I don't know. I don't know.
Is Puppeteer involved in this? Is that kind of the big thing? Chrome, like Google Chrome team released Puppeteer, which like is like Node powered headless Chrome or something. Is that right?
Oh, no.
And I think JS DOM is tied into this as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It sounds like that's actual builds of, if it's the Chrome team, it sounds like those are like you'll actually be running Chrome. So JS DOM is just like this. Pure JavaScript, sort of like.
Now you have
pretending like we're a browser, but not a real browser.
Note that JS DOM still does not do any layout or rendering, so this is really just about pretending to be visual, not about implementing parts of that. Which is kind of interesting because it could still run your tests, probably.
Yeah, exactly. And well, like Jest, the test framework that Facebook uses, that a lot of people use with React, that uses JS DOM under the hood. So yeah, I think Puppeteer would probably be.
It's probably faster if it doesn't have to do any of the other stuff.
Yeah, exactly. When you're running thousands and thousands of tests, that stuff matters.
Yeah,
you'd almost rather just have some sort of like headless pass, basically, right? Like just no rendering.
So I wonder if Puppeteer replaces Karma, because Karma was the tool that came out of the Angular team. Of course, Google is kind of famous for having like three or four different JavaScript frameworks at a time.
Competing chat apps.
I'd
say even Angular, the different versions of Angular compete against each other.
Yeah, right.
That's going to have to hold for another time. And we didn't even get to talk about Unpackage. Perhaps we'll have you come back another time or we'll figure out something interesting to do with it. But I think we got to Scoop it up, Mr.
TLDR and unpackaged is use it, right?
TLDR is, you know, unpackaged is, it was just basically like this thing to, you know, get it's a global CDN. It's hosted by Cloudflare. Get any file on NPM on a global CDN, on a fast global CDN. That's it. It's currently doing about, it's almost at 8 billion hits a month now, which is, I kind of look at that and think, I built something that does 8 billion hits a month. I mean, that's not new to Chris, right? CSS Tricks probably does like twice
we,
that.
I don't think we get a billion hits.
Billion's a big number.
But it's just like, who are these people? And it's funny because I checked the logs and I'm like, yeah. Like, who was it?
So people use it in production. They must.
Oh my
be.
Gosh! Yes, it was like a banking website, like Citigroup or something. And I was.
Oh yeah, it's amazing what happens. We've totally had banks even write into CodePen, and we had one of those tax companies last year wrote in, and they're like, "Listen, we're under code freeze because tax season just started, and somebody pushed a thing that links to a JavaScript resource on your site.
Oh,
so can
gosh.
You super please not change it on us?" Because we can't
You've
fix it.
You've got to be kidding me.
Yeah, oh sure. Gosh. Well, we'll go ahead and not change that for you. Feel free to sign up for a team account, though. That'd be nice.
We are a confident bunch of developers, aren't we? We just like, I found this file on the internet. I'm just going to link to it. Published. Wow. We are funny folks. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I mean, I guess we could do it quickly, but there's all kinds of magic with unpackaged.
Yeah.
Like, and it makes me, like, one of the things is, like, I want to be able to link to something, and I have no confidence whether the thing on NPM is ready to be dealt with by in-browser modules or not.
Yeah. So we're kind of, you know, doing a lot of experiments. It's fun, actually, to be able to run these experiments. So one of the hottest things, latest things is modules on the web, right? ES modules, script type equals module. And it's something that Unpackaged currently supports in an experimental way is you can say, you know, if somebody is publishing ES modules to NPM and you
How
are
do you
in
know?
A, they'll indicate it with, in your package JSON, you'll have a main entry that points to the common JS entry point and then a module entry point that points to your ESM entry point.
Look at that.
Yeah. So we'll look at that. But then the trick is when you're looking at all of the files. So say I'm serving you a module to a browser that understands ES modules and I've got a bunch of import statements at the top. Well, those import statements are going to come back to my server, right? They're actually loading stuff over the network for browsers that understand ES modules. And so we have to translate those import statements so that those are importing ES modules as well.
Infinitely.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. So I.
No wonder you got 8 billion. There's really a circular reference to there.
Well, so if for people who are more interested in this, I ran a demo at last year's React Rally conference where I demoed loading all of D3 in the latest Chrome Canary, which at that time supported ES modules. And I think it was like 765 requests or something crazy like that. But it worked, which was the cool thing. You know, it was like, oh. So there's still a lot of exploring to do, still a lot of experimentation to do with modules on the web. But Unpackaged is, you know, it's helping people, I guess, to experiment by just making it possible.
Right.
Cool.
You don't have to NPM install. Right. Okay, Dave, wrap it up.
Hey, all right. Thank you, Michael, for coming on the show. For those who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do
that? Oh, yeah. So my business right now is reacttraining.com. So go there and check out our workshops. We've got, like I said, we've got them coming up in Austin, New York, Chicago, Boston. We're going to be announcing Seattle very shortly, Silicon Valley. So go to reacttraining.com and sign up to find out more about React. Also, I'm M. Jackson on Twitter. Open source work is at github.com/reacttraining. And yeah, that's about it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star, heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.